Shalom. Thank you for joining us on this journey of discovery through the book of Deuteronomy.
Shalom and good morning to all of you. Welcome back to our study in Deuteronomy. We are so excited to get back into the heart of this book. And today we are looking at many of the laws starting from chapter 19. But last week we ended at chapter 18. And there was this one verse that I thought I'd just go back. It says in chapter 18, verse 18, I will raise up for them, this is God saying, a prophet like you, that is like Moses, from among their brethren. Okay, so God is going to raise up a prophet like Moses. And this is what God says. And will put my words in his mouth, and he shall speak to them all that I command him. And I thought that was a really good way to start, because when you think about God saying that, who do you think of? You think about Jesus, because in Jesus, John chapter 12, verse 49 to 50, that was exactly, and actually I thought, who's reading today? Seng Yen? Okay, Titus reading for us, John chapter 12, verse 49 to 50. Okay.
John chapter 12, verse 49 to 50. For I have not spoken on my own authority, but the Father who sent me gave me a command, what I should say and what I should speak. And I know that his command is everlasting life. Therefore, whatever I speak, just as the Father has told me, so I speak.
So really, this is a very good indication for us that in Jesus' ministry, it's very clear that Jesus was often thinking about Deuteronomy. This is just an encouragement for us who are today, and today as we are recording this, this is actually the day after the rabbinic Yom Kippur, depending on how you count. The Karaite Jews or count today as Yom Kippur. So, you know, this is a time when we're thinking about the heart of God. And Jesus was constantly thinking about Deuteronomy, as you can kind of see from this example. But with that, we're going to jump straight into chapter 19. And in Deuteronomy chapter 19, what you find is a whole bunch of laws. And in particular, now we have this law. When the Lord, your God, has cut off all these nations whose land are before you. Let me just kind of cut to the chase. You set up cities of refuge. Okay, so there are some cities of refuge that you're supposed to set up. Three of them are on the east side of the Jordan. And this would be the Golan, the Ramoth, Golan, Ramoth, and Bezer. And on the west side of Jordan, which is modern-day Israel today, is this in the north, Kadesh, Shechem in the middle in Samaria, today Samaria, and Hebron in the south. So you have these cities of refuge that are spread throughout the place so that some people can. So what kind of people would go to a city of refuge? So you look at the text. Basically, it describes to us the kind of people who can take advantage of this, right? Basically, people who are, verse 4, and this is the case of the manslayer who flees there. Okay, so you got a manslayer. I think that includes woman slayer or, you know, whatever kind of slayer, that he may live. Why are you going to spare this manslayer? You know, whoever kills his neighbor unintentionally. Okay, so what this is modern law, you call it manslaughter, right? So maybe in a fit of anger, you did plan to kill the guy, but maybe you're just fighting and accidentally in the scuffle, he falls down, he knocks his head on a rock and he dies unintentionally. Now, this is really interesting because I think it gives us a slight nuance because, you know, this law in the Old Testament is an eye for an eye or tooth for a tooth. And this was the law of the day. It's called the law lex talionis, the law of talionis. I can't remember what that actually means, but basically an eye for an eye. So the Bible is actually a little bit more discerning. It's not just an eye for an eye. It considers the motive of the heart. So here, it considers two things. First, the intention of the person was not to kill, but due to criminal negligence or maybe drunk driving, right? We'll think, wow, the drunk driver, you know, he shouldn't have done it. But, well, it was careless. It was a mistake. It was unintentional. He didn't go out that night thinking, I'm going to kill somebody, right? Secondly, the second consideration is you should not take vengeance. Because now there are other people who is angry with this person and they want to kill him intentionally, right? So in order to prevent this secondary problem, you have all these cities that people can run to. And I think that's good because it really reminds us that the law of God is actually discerning and it concerns the intention of the heart. It's always thinking about that, right? In this chapter, verse 5, it gives this example. It says, if a man goes to the woods with his neighbor, okay, so you're going out to the wood, you're working to cut timber, and his hand swings a stroke with the axe to cut down the tree, and the head slips from the handle and strikes his neighbor, so he dies. So that's an example of accidental, you know, I mean, you didn't mean to do it, but you accidentally do it. And in 2 Kings chapter 6, verse 5, you have something similar. This guy was cutting, but fortunately in that case, the axe head fell into the water and did not hit anybody. So seems like those days, this was a very common thing. You go chopping tree, must wear helmet. Okay. Verse 10, lest innocent blood be shed in the midst of your land, and the Lord your God is giving you as an inheritance. Okay, so the whole idea is that this person who kills someone accidentally, if you kill him, you are still shedding what blood? Innocent blood. That means in the eyes of the Lord, this guy is actually innocent, even though he might have accidentally committed a grievous problem of taking a life by another person, right? So I think that's really quite interesting. You know, I think this goes on to show something quite useful for us, right? So if you have your Bibles, Exodus chapter 21, something interesting for us to discuss, right? Verse 22 to 25.
If men fight and hurt a woman with a child so that she gives birth prematurely, yet no harm follows, he shall surely be punished accordingly as the woman's husband imposes on him, and he shall pay as the judges determine. But if any harm follows, then you shall give life for life, eye for eye, tooth for tooth, hand for hand, foot for foot, burn for burn, wound for wound, stripe for stripe.
Okay, so this is really quite interesting. So here's more case law, right? So now you have these two guys who are, you know, fighting, I don't know, for whatever thing, and the pregnant wife or one of the guys standing nearby. So in the course of this fighting, maybe, you know, they are doing some fancy move, accidentally hits the woman. And so now the question is, if you hit a woman and you cause her to give birth prematurely, right? So if the child is fine, is okay, then, well, you just have to pay. Stop fighting already, and now it's pay fine time, right? So now you have to pay some compensation that the man requires. But look at that. That's the second part. If any harm follows, what does that mean? If any harm follows, problem means if the child dies, right? So if what happens if the child dies? So it goes on to say, meaning that you should give eye for eye, tooth for tooth, hand for... Okay, basically, life for life. So that's the lex talionis, right? Now, the reason why I bring this up is because it's sort of related to these cities of refuge, if you can run there in time. But also the law is a life for a life. So that means if the baby dies, what happens to the man? He dies. Okay, so why is this interesting for us? Because in our context, there's a whole debate, you know, on whether the baby, unborn baby, is alive or not, right? So if you really look at this law, sometimes you get these clues that in this context, it would seem that the unborn child is counted as a life that would be equivalent to the life of a living person, and it still applies life to life. Right? Something for you to think about. You know. So I guess now how far back this goes, I guess it's a matter of controversial debate. But definitely... In this case, one could make a strong case that abortion is actually killing, it's actually murder, right? I think that would be one of the verses that you could look to. Okay, so we're going to move on a little bit from all these cities of refuge, right? Okay, I should mention verse 11 to 13, back to Deuteronomy chapter 19. Verse 11 to 13 offers no refuge for actual murderers. So let's say you actually murdered somebody, and you ran to one of these cities of refuge. Wrong place, right? You should run to the wilderness, find a cave, hide somewhere like Osama bin Laden. Verse 15, it says that you need at least two witnesses, right? So if you're going to bring an accusation to someone, then you should not just have one person. And you find this being echoed in the New Testament. You know, when there's a discipline issue, you should, you know, have two persons to report this person. And just the word of one person is not sufficient, right? There are some other problematic aspects of this law, but we won't get into it today. Not only should you have witnesses, verse 16 to 21 basically says that when there are conflicting testimonies, these are all case laws. How does a judge handle cases, right? So the judge will study this. Okay, if there are conflicting testimonies from different witnesses, one says this, the other says, so the judge's job is to actually to investigate, right? So that's also a value of biblical law, is that it's concerned with accuracy of truth, fairness, and so on and so forth, right? And if the witness is found to be false, okay, so if the person giving false witness, whatever he charged the other person with shall fall upon himself. Okay, so for example, you say, you know, he broke my window, right? And he needs to pay me, you know, maybe half a shekel for that window. And it turns out that no, actually, I saw the cow broke the window. Okay, now you have to pay whatever you're demanding from that person. You know, if we did this, I think there'll be a lot less false witnesses around, right? Because most of the time, false witnesses just get away scot-free, right? Let's go on, therefore, to chapter 20. See, we're moving really quickly. Some interesting stuff. Laws for war, okay? Some rules about not fearing your enemies. God will be with you. When you go out to fight, God will go out with you. In other words, God won't go out for you. God will go out with you. You still have to do the fighting, right? And then verses 5 onwards, you have a whole bunch of exemptions. Who are exempted from NS, you know? I guess NS. If you just build a new house and you have not dedicated it, right? Then you don't have to go out for war, right? Well, I guess if this was in Singapore, everyone will build houses and not dedicate it. just as a way of getting out, you know? But, you know, I guess, so you are supposed to have an opportunity to start the household with your family. Okay, usually when you build a house in the Old Testament context, you only do that when you're getting married, right? So, of course, if you look in the New Testament, there's this whole idea of the bridegroom, you know, I'm going to go away to build mansions for you. If I were not doing that, why would I go away, right? So the whole idea is I go away, I'm going to build a mansion because we are going to get married, right? So this has to do with the idea of getting married. Verse 6, it's not exactly the same thing, but it says, you know, you plant a vineyard, but you haven't harvested it even once, okay? So, you know, you get a chance to harvest, the first fruits, right? And verse 7, if you are betrothed, but you haven't consummated the marriage, right? You should go so that at the very least, you have an opportunity to have an offspring. Maybe you die at war. At least your widowed wife will not be barren. So there's some children going on there. Verse 8, anyone who is afraid or faint-hearted, you don't have to go to war. Okay, I think this will also be another problem if we implement this law here. Everyone will be running away from the place because they're scared, right? But why do they have this law? Well, partly because you don't want the scaredy cat out in the war, in the battlefield to demoralize and discourage everyone else, right? So that's sort of like the stuff going on there. And then you have more rules of war in verse 10, Deuteronomy chapter 20, verse 10.
When you go near a city to fight against it, then proclaim an offer of peace to it.
Okay, look at this. We remember this, right? Do you remember this? When you go to fight, now remember when they were turning north from Seir to go up to, Og Bashan and Sihon, King Sihon, right? Of Heshbon. So God says you have to basically go to war against them. What did Moses do? Well, basically he went and offered a peace deal. And we were wondering at that time, why did they do that? And well, lo and behold, turns out there is a protocol that apparently, so before you fight, so what does it mean to offer peace? What does it mean to offer peace? Mean that we don't fight? No, that is not what to offer peace means. To offer peace means you surrender. Okay, that is what it actually means. Okay, now if they should surrender, here's what happens in verse 11. It says, if they should accept your offer of peace and open to you, then all the people who are found shall be placed under tribute to you and serve you. So that is actually surrender. So I guess you can go back and now it makes sense. Because when we think offer peace, we think that, okay, let's not fight, right? But actually, this is demanding an unconditional surrender, right? So if you surrender, then nobody has to die, okay, but you will serve us. Okay, so we're going to move on a little bit. Some rules, okay, about what should you do if they don't surrender. Well, if they don't surrender, you shall strike every male in the city with the edge of a sword. This is verse 13. But the women, the little ones, the livestock, and all, okay, so all the women, the animals, the children, all the spoil, you can take for yourself. Okay, this you shall take for yourself. This is a little bit interesting, right? Because, well, we have some other laws that says you must utterly destroy everything. And here you have, and so what actually is going on here? Well, it's actually different kind of cities. You look down to verse 15, it says, thus you shall do to the cities which are very far away from you, which are not of the cities of the nations. In other words, this has to do with cities not in the land of Canaan itself. Okay? In the land of Canaan itself, you have this hacherem, you know, utter destruction law. But for those, let's say, far north, far south, or maybe maybe in the Transjordan, then there appears to be a slightly more lenient laws pertaining to them, right? And I think that's kind of, now, why do we have a more lenient law? Well, perhaps it's because God was very concerned about the idolatry in Canaan, right? And wants to stamp that out. Whereas those people are further, has less influence on the people because you're not really going to stay in those lands, you see. So, something to consider, very interesting stuff. The cities that are very far away. All right. Of course, verse 6 onwards, then you have the, but for the cities of those people which the Lord your God gives you as an inheritance that's in the land, okay, you shall let nothing that breathes remain alive. So now in this case, nothing that breathes, that includes the animals, lah, right? Animals also breathe, right? So nothing, no man, woman, no child, very, very severe laws. But of course, then you wonder, in Joshua chapter 8, verse 27. Okay, maybe let's just look at Joshua chapter 8, verse 27 real quick. Now this, remember, Moses was giving all these laws before they enter into the land, right? Before the book of Joshua, before they step in and started conquering the land. So now Joshua goes into the land and he says to us, he did everything as Moses told him to do, right? So let's look at Joshua chapter 8, verse 27, right? So they go to the city of Ai. They destroy the city of Ai. And but verse 27, it says, now Ai is in the promised land. We know it's very near Jericho. So this is totally in the promised land. But it says, only the livestock and the spoil of the city Israel took as booty among themselves. But it says, according to the word of the Lord, which he commanded Joshua. Okay, now this is confusing, right? Because that is certainly part of the promise. What? Now, were they confused? I don't know. Some of these things, you know, it's a bit of a mystery. But it's interesting to note these things because you can go back and ask yourself in greater detail what exactly is going on here, right? So sometimes they seem to have spared them. I find it a bit puzzling. You know, why did they consider this city of Ai exempted from that and other cities perhaps not? So maybe it would seem to me that they didn't do this for all cities. Maybe that was the case, right? Was that disobeying God's commandment? I don't think we'll actually know, right? Verse 19 says, don't cut down the trees. When you besiege a city for a long time while making, so to take a siege of a city, what you do is you just camp around the city. You're not going in. You just prevent anyone from going in and out. So the whole idea is that if nobody can go in and out, sooner or later they'll run out of food and they run out of water and just basically surrender, right? But it says, do not cut down the trees. Wow, I think that's a very interesting thing, right? You shall not destroy the tree by wielding an axe against it. You can eat, if you can eat of them, right? Do not cut them down to use in the siege. Now, why do they use trees in the siege? Well, sometimes to build a ramp, sometimes to build fires and so on and so forth. I also don't know exactly why there's this special concern for trees, right? Maybe it was a kind of early environmental concern, right? I guess it's a wisdom thing, right? Is this, you might wonder, why is this a law, all right? So, as I said, I think many of these were Moses taking the principle of God and really translating that into cultural context so that they will have some practical laws. They are not like first-order constitutional laws. You will not find this in the constitution of your country, right? You open, the constitution of the nation is you can only cut certain cut. You won't find that. These are, I guess, the practical outworking of some of the principles of the law. So chapter 21, very interesting. Okay, we're going to spend a little bit of time on chapter 21 here because maybe we can just read verse 1 to 9.
Chapter 21, verse 1 to 9. If anyone is found slain, lying in a field in the land which the Lord your God is giving you to possess, and it is not known who killed him, then your elders and your judges shall go out and measure the distance from the slain man to the surrounding cities. And it shall be that the elders of the city nearest to the slain man will take a heifer which has not been worked and which has not been put with a yoke. The elders of that city shall bring the heifer down to the valley with flowing water, which is neither ploughed nor sown, and they shall break the heifer's neck there in the valley. Then the priests, the sons of Levi, shall come near, for the Lord your God has chosen them to minister to him and to bless in the name of the Lord. By their word, every controversy and every assault shall be settled. And all the elders of that city nearest to the slain man shall wash their hands over the heifer whose neck was broken in the valley. Then they shall answer and say, our hands have not shed this blood, nor have our eyes seen it. Provide atonement, O Lord, for your people Israel, whom you have redeemed, and do not lay innocent blood to the charge of your people Israel. And atonement shall be provided on their behalf for the blood. So you shall put away the guilt of innocent blood from among you when you do what is right in the sight of the Lord.
Okay, this is a fascinating passage. Honestly, in all my years, I never heard anyone preach a sermon from this passage because it's a little bit weird, okay? So basically, the situation is there's some unknown dead guy, okay? So when there's there are several concepts that are interesting, okay? So let's just think about this. First of all, unknown, who is responsible for the unknown dead guy? Well, normally, nobody. But here, who becomes responsible? You measure, you know. The nearest city becomes responsible. I can imagine someone in the night just dragging the guy over the border, just a little bit over to that, right? Why? Because you see, that city is going to have to sacrifice a heifer, right? A heifer is a bull, right? So you have to sacrifice. In other words, it costs you something. This is going to cost your city something. Now, there are a couple of things going on here. First of all, there's this whole idea of collective responsibility, right? There's a although it may not be you, but there is a sense that cities have, in other words, it's not just individual responsibility at work. The whole city, whoever it is, has this sense of collective responsibility. You'll find other laws that also reflect this whole idea that if something happens, then the whole city, if they don't know, the whole city must take responsibility for that particular thing. And this idea of collective responsibility is quite a prevalent one in the Old Testament, whereas in our time we tend to think of individual responsibility, right? I didn't do it, so why should I pay? But in the Old Testament, they thought a little bit differently. Although it's not so clear cut, you know, I mean, in Genesis chapter 18, Abraham did ask God, you know, should the innocent die together with the wicked, right? So there's this sense of the responsibility should only fall on the individuals who have caused the sin. But here you have this idea of collective responsibility. So that's the first thing to think about. The second thing is what they did. So what did they do? They had this heifer, right? And what it says here is that the elders, they will wash their hands over the heifer whose neck was broken in the valley. So they take the heifer, they're going to break this, well, they're going to kill the heifer, right? And they're going to wash their hands where? Over the neck, right? Over the heifer whose neck. Actually, it's really kind of over the neck. And this is very similar to Leviticus chapter 4, verse 15, which is how you actually sacrifice. So during the sacrifice of a heifer or a bull, what you would normally do is you would normally put your hand on the neck or the head. The neck would be the back, the head, right? The oref. You put on the animal, and what do you do when you do that? You normally will confess your sins. So in that act of confession, something happens. It's like you're transferring your whatever unintentional sins, not sins, just unintentional sins, on the animal, which then dies to make atonement for you. This whole concept of what you call substitutionary atonement, this is one of those places where you find this, that this animal kind of dies in your place. But it's a catch-all. You don't actually know what you've done wrong, but this is, we just confess that whatever it is that we have done wrong, this kind of washes it and kind of closes the issue so that maybe there are no further dispute later on. In future, when we study Leviticus 4:15, you can see this. But if you want, you can go back and look at that whole section onwards. Okay, moving on. Verse 10, also very interesting. Now we're getting to all this really fascinating stuff, right? Verse 10 says, when you go to war against your enemies and the Lord your God delivers them into your hands, you take them captives. Okay, so you take one of these cities captives. It has to be one of those cities that are far away, right? Because, you know, look, there are no captives if they are those cities in the promised land. You're supposed to kill all of them. So presumably, this is one of those far away, maybe out in Sidon in the north, maybe out in Lebanon. Okay, so you are there. You take them captive. And you see among the captives, get this, a beautiful woman, okay, and you desire her and would take her for your wife, okay. So maybe in the middle of killing and whacking down the whole city, you see this woman and say, "Aiyah, sayang lah," you know, this one, maybe wife material, right? For whatever reason, the main reason is because she looks good, okay. So she looks good, So what do you do? Okay, here is where you get the whole bunch of super interesting. First, you actually can take them as a slave, right? So does that mean that the Bible endorses the concept of slavery? And a lot of people will say this, you know. So what is going on? Clearly, there were slaves in the Bible, right? And you do take some of these people. We read some passage about bond slaves as well. So there were slaves in the Bible. Why didn't... Well, I guess during those days, as we're mentioning, slavery had a social function. These are very poor people who could not feed for themselves, right? They could not survive. Slavery was a way by which they actually gained some sort of support and covering. And after some years, they are released anyway. Okay, so it's not like lifelong slavery, except for the bond slave. That was what we did in the last episode. Okay, one of the last few episodes. But in this case, it's a bit different. It's not a slave now. You're going to take this person as a wife. You know, does she have any say? You know, I wonder. Well, I guess between being killed or being a slave and being a wife, you know, sort of like not much of a choice, right? In any case, suppose she says yes. Okay, I'll marry you, you know. I've got nothing to lose out here. Now, in verse 12, this is what it says. She shall put off the clothes of her captivity, remain in your house, and mourn her father and her mother a full month. Why is she going to mourn for her father and mother? They're probably killed. All right, that's right. They were probably killed in the battle. So she will mourn for them, right? After that, you may go into her. That's the nice way of saying you will, you know, have relations with her and be her husband. Now, you got to remember. Today, when you want to get married, you go to ROM, you know, you sign this, you sign that, you know, do all these things, you know, maybe have a wedding in church. Those days, the way you marry someone is basically you just take the woman and that's how you get married, okay? And if you've done that, you're married, okay? So, now, the part that you want to see is verse 12. It says, you shall bring her to your house and she shall shave her head and trim her nails. What do you think that's all about? Morning, right? So not because she's dirty, right? Maybe a lice problem, okay? Well, maybe it was a health issue, but she will shave her head. But do you remember Deuteronomy chapter 14, verse 1? So quickly look at Deuteronomy. We already covered this, but you've probably forgotten, okay? It says, you are the children of the Lord your God. You shall not cut yourselves nor shave the front of your head for the dead, right? So you shall not mourn the dead. So here we have an example where it is an indication of the practice of the nations around you. Among their practices is in fact to shave their heads for the dead. Now, does that mean shave completely bald like Kojak? Some of you are too young to know who's Kojak. But, you know, to be completely bald, very likely is just to shave the front of the head as an act of mourning. So it would appear here that you have this provision, okay? Before you get married, so you're still a pagan, okay, you want to mourn your father, we'll still give you an allowance. You mourn your father in the way that you feel most comfortable. But after that, you are married already, right? So no more the kind of, now you have to keep the law. Very interesting. You know, you don't see this hard or harsh application of the law. You see almost as if, yeah, this application of law, very important, very harsh sometimes. But now and then you see this little bit of leeway given for people who don't fully understand yet. Because here's someone who is a pagan. She won't understand. She only knows how to mourn in one way. So that's, you know, that gray area between someone and... So, you know, in the process of someone becoming a Christian, they may not know everything yet, right? So along the way, you know, it would seem that the Bible exhibits that sort of thing. I guess some people may disagree, but that's just what it looks like, okay? So anyway, we kind of move on. You marry the person. You thought, okay, she looks good. And then... it shall be that, verse 14, if you have no delight in her, okay, what is going on here, right? Maybe after you marry her, you found that, wow, she really, I don't know, man, she snores really loudly, you know, or maybe she nags nonstop, or for whatever reason, now you kind of have bias remorse, okay? You kind of marry her, you say, I shouldn't have done that, I really should, I don't like her, right? So what happens? It shall be that you know that you shall set her free. Wow, look at that. What does that even mean? You shall set her free. Shalach. Shalach. That word here, free. Set her free is shalach. Shalach means what? Release her. It is also the word that's translated divorce her. That is actually what literally this means. You shall divorce her. Okay. Now, if you divorce her, right, you shall certainly not sell her for money because she's not a slave. She was your wife, right? So this person now has already gained normal citizen status, right? So you cannot just, okay, no, I don't like her. No, I changed my mind. You know, I already kind of slept with her. Now I just want to sell her. No, she's free now. She doesn't belong to you, because that's what shalak divorce means. When you divorce someone, you release the person from whatever covenantal clause. This person no longer belongs to you. It's free to do whatever that person wants to do, right? But you should not treat her brutally because you have humbled her. Now, that's just a euphemism for saying that you slept with her or you've taken her virginity, okay? I need to keep this whole thing PG-18, so I won't go too much into all that. But there was another person in the Bible that you have this situation. Don't you remember? In Genesis chapter 21. Remember when Abraham took Hagar? Because, you know, Sarah couldn't have a child. So he took Hagar and had a child, Ishmael. Then what happened afterwards? Sarah was not happy, right? I mean, this whole situation. So could have been one of the reasons. Took no delight in her. What did they do to Hagar? Send her out. Yishalakta, that's the same word. Literally divorced her. You know, not just, you're still my wife, but, you know, you stay in another town. Actually, that word there is to release her, to divorce her. And that's probably why afterwards you hardly hear about Hagar anymore, right? So something to think about, very interesting, right? And of course, now you get on, it gets even more interesting, right? And complicated. Verse 15, I shall have Titus read this for us. Deuteronomy chapter 21, verse 15.
If a man has two wives, one loved and the other unloved, and they have borne him children, both the loved and the unloved, and if the firstborn son is of her who is unloved, then it shall be on the day he bequeaths his possessions to his sons that he must not bestow firstborn status on the son of the loved wife in preference to the son of the unloved, the true firstborn.
Okay, we can just pause there for a second, right? So basically, before you even can jump into the whole who's unloved and unloved, all that stuff, if a man has two wives, okay, what's going on here? I mean, it's obvious that in those days, polygamy was a thing. It was a thing, right? And there's no number set on how many wives. I mean, in some religions, there is a limit on how many wives you can have. Actually, in this context, at least, I think the limit is how much you can afford, lah, basically, or how much you can put up with it, right? So it is not surprising that you find even people like David, which is a very one of the most so-called revered characters in your Old Testament, having up to six wives, I think, at least. Okay, not this is the early stage. Later on, you don't know how many political concubines and all that. We certainly had concubines in addition to the wives. And of course, his son Solomon like really did the best, right? So, yeah, that is a reality. I think it doesn't help us to kind of deny, no, all these words. No, look, it's a reality. You just kind of deal with it, right? Was it ideal? Yeah, you can argue whether it's ideal or not. You know, there are some people say, well, to be a bishop, you have to have one wife, right? But you're not a bishop now. So, you know, there's this whole debate that's going on, which is why I keep coming back to the whole issue that I think we cannot read these laws devoid of its context. These laws are formed in context, you see. Within our context, we will form the same principles, but it might take a slightly different shape. Okay, so now, what is this section about? This is about favoritism, right? You have normally the eldest son, okay, the firstborn, whichever, the firstborn has a certain priority within the family. Now, you might ask, why should the firstborn have, right? Look, that's just the culture, right? Today, and it's not just firstborn, it's the firstborn son. Okay, if you are the firstborn daughter, sorry, okay, that doesn't really count a whole lot. But in today's world, if you are firstborn, secondborn, I don't know, I don't. Any firstborn here? Yeah, there's some firstborn son. Yeah, quite a few of you, right? Firstborn son all belong to the Lord, by the way. That's why you're full time. So there's a situation where there's sort of like favoritism. You see, the second wife you kind of like, and when you die, okay. Well, obviously, when you die, you're dead. So in the discharge of your laws, you may want to leave instructions to, and I want to give more to this, you know, favorites. You're not allowed to do that because it is wrong culturally, right? But, I mean, that part, to us is not super relevant, partly because, yeah, you've got a question here.
So how do we explain this in the light of Ishmael and Isaac?
Yeah, yeah, that's right. Super interesting, right? One way you can say it, he didn't know. This law was not given yet, right? That would be one way of saying why Ishmael. Of course, the question is, what about Ishmael? Wouldn't Ishmael be the firstborn? Some people will actually argue that, right? But though he is the firstborn, he's not the son of promise. Okay, so that's the other thing. Yeah, in that case, it's not so much the inheritance that's being given. It's sort of the idea that God actually promised specifically something to the firstborn of Sarah, right? So that was a special case, and this was sort of like a something went wrong, miscarriage of that whole idea. But certainly, I think that's worth thinking about. Certainly worth thinking about. So yeah, I think that's actually a very good question from Chilip, right? But let's kind of go on a little bit, right? So normally what happens with the firstborn? Now, in this case, the example is you only have two sons. So what happens, how do you divide the inheritance? So normally, the firstborn will get twice as much as the third son. Okay, so let's say I have $1,000. How much does the firstborn get? 666, right? Okay, maybe I should have used $900, right? So to avoid the number, right? You get two-thirds of it, right? And that two-thirds is what you call a double portion, right? What is a double portion? Shenayim pi. A double, literally a two-thirds. Now, where do we hear this word, a double portion, again? Elijah wanted a double. So, you know, some people say double portion means twice as much as Elijah had. No. That wasn't, it's not talking about quantitatively twice Elijah. If anything, it will be two-thirds of what Elijah had. But basically, he's saying that I want to be your rightful heir, right? Your firstborn heir. So this whole idea of quantizing the thing, I think is probably a bit wrong. But it's interesting because, you know, from here we get into that. Okay, and we are at 40 minutes, so we're going to call this, wrap this up here, and we're going to continue in the next episode as we look at the stubborn son, okay? What happens to stubborn kids? And for all you parents, don't miss our next episode. God bless you, and I'll see you all in the next episode.
We hope you enjoyed studying the Word of God. Join us again as we continue through the Book of Devarim.